just want to talk about this thing that's in my brain. It keeps me from wanting to go on, but I want some gain. Maybe a little fame. The second time. How about that? Welcome to the We the Patriots podcast. I'm your host, Sal Asante. And with me today, again, I will say, is Dr. John Marshall. John, how are you doing today?
Oh, very good. Thanks.
I'm glad to see that you are. I think that you picked out an outfit that was exactly the same as last time or damn close.
I did. I did that. You know, this is TV business. We're supposed to be able to like merge one thing into the other. You know, you don't need to tell everybody we're editing this thing. No, it's okay.
No. I used the same background,
the same shirt, so that you could just kind of seamlessly.
That's all on me. I take full blame. I will cut it together. So what does eventually, when we do get up on YouTube, I will put up the whole podcast in one, and I'll leave it as like a one continuous, and I'll cut it together so they don't see me blabber and all about me messing up. But I thought it was very funny. I forgot to hit the record button on one of our most important conversations. It was very fun. But we ended up really bleeding it into, I thought, a great conversation. The only thing I was really missing was kind of why exactly you had the background that you did. And that's kind of what I wanted to revisit today and kind of cover, if you're good with that, John. So I would love to start it off by just kind of getting into it, really your educational background, why you decided to go for such a prestigious school. I know if everybody saw part one there, you saw that you went to Harvard, played baseball there even. So you were really highly academically gifted. But what made you go to Harvard in the first place? What made you even strive for that?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I was like, quote unquote, striving for that in high school. Like, in high school, I was just doing, I know it's funny because now, having worked in education for 20 years, there's so much of an emphasis on college prep. You go to a lot of, especially some of the charter schools and things like that, where every homeroom is named after a college and they've got college pennants and banners everywhere. We really didn't have much of that going on. I mean, there was like kind of in the background, people go off to college, but aside from maybe a bulletin board down by the guidance office, there wasn't like that daily emphasis. It was your daily emphasis was to do your chemistry homework, to do your, get through calc, to write your history paper. And so I don't think I was ever like particularly aiming for one school or another. In fact, aside from going to some academic competitions and playing some sporting events on different college campuses, like we played at Yogi Berra Stadium on Montclair campus, and we played and we did academic decathlon on the Drew campus, and I did a summer program at Monmouth, local schools here. I really didn't have a whole lot of like college exposure. I had never even visited a college campus till my junior year. And then that summer, my dad had I had always followed Notre Dame football. I love Notre Dame. He had a business trip to Chicago, so I kind of tagged along. It was over the summer. And then we took a day and drove down to South Bend and checked out the campus. But that was, course, it was the first one I had really seen, other than some local thing, campuses. And so it was like, wow, this is the greatest. And I was all about Notre Dame for a while. Right. But when senior year came, I didn't really have a plan. I applied to 10 schools, mostly based on ones that I kind of liked from what I had either heard about or seen on TV. And some of it was sports related and didn't really have a great plan, but I applied to a couple Ivies, a couple, good independent schools, Notre Dame, Duke. I applied to some public schools, UVA, and all the way across the board. I think I applied to some big schools, some small schools. Like, I applied to William and Mary and Franklin and Marshall, some pretty small schools, because I really hadn't had a chance to explore a lot. And quite honestly, it did not have a great sense of where I would get in. It's like when you're in a tiny high school with, my graduating class was something like 80 I don't know, 7 or something like that. It was really small.
Right.
You know, you just don't know how a big school is going to interpret that. You know, it's like, okay, what does your class rank really mean? What do your grades really mean? So I kind of applied to like 10 schools, which at the time was a lot. And actually there's a new story going around. It's like some kid who's gotten accepted to like 170 or 190 schools or something crazy like that, which is, I mean, obviously the kid's very accomplished, good for him. But on the other hand, I think it's also a little excessive because you can say, like, oh, I got 300 million in scholarships. Well, yeah, but you can't use them all. You can only use one. So, okay. Right. Yeah. But in any case, so I applied to 10 and just kind of figured I'd see what happened. And actually the funny story with it is that I had, at that time, everything was by mail. It wasn't like there was no email or check online to see if you got in. And typically you got the acceptances around April the 1st, and April the 1st came around, and I was busy playing baseball and all, and I had gotten 9 out of the 10 responses on April 1st or 2nd, and I had not heard from Harvard. But I had gotten into Notre Dame, I had gotten into Duke, I had a couple good scholarship offers to consider. So I was really kind of deciding there, and had almost written off Harvard. And then it was late, like April the, I don't know, 8th or 9th or something like that, that the Harvard letter came. And it's like, oh, shoot, this complicates things a little bit. And
for sure, I can imagine.
So what
was
the
thought process there? Were you pretty much on the way to Notre Dame at that point, and then it was really hard?
I think so. I mean, Notre Dame offered me, of all the other schools, Notre Dame offered me the most money, and it was a school I had loved. And so we actually had made plans to go back out there.
Go visit again.
One final check on that. Yep. And so actually, and I really hadn't done a lot of school visiting, because when you're in basketball and baseball, you just don't have time to like go away for 3 days. So there were a couple times where we picked, like, I don't know, I think, once all the acceptances came back, that April became kind of just a blur, because I think we'd have like baseball game or practice on Saturday morning. And then, you know, it's like immediately like quick, take a shower, leave right from the school, go off to Boston or go up, you know, go down to Virginia or whatever. So I think we did a couple visits like in that month there.
Right.
And I will say, I mean, when you have your mind made up in any direction and then something new comes along, it's like a tough mental barrier to then, because I had pretty much in my mind, I think, decided I was going to Notre Dame, and and then this Harvard thing came along, and it's like, oh well, shoot. And Harvard were, you know, certainly at that certainly now, and even at that time, was very, very generous on financial aid. Now, like today, if we were applying based on my parents' income, I would have gone for free, completely free. Even at that time, they were the most generous in terms of financial aid.
Really?
And so it was, when it really came down to is I love Notre Dame. I really like Duke, and I have liked a lot of the other options. But it's hard to say no to Harvard, and when they gave you the most money. And so I went down to the last day with the three response cards in front of me. Yeah. And I think I was driving everybody crazy. And the last night, like, because he had to respond by May 1st or whatever. Like the last night, I'm sitting in the basement with like all three cards, and my dad was like, I'm going to bed. But his comment to me as he went to bed was, it's like, look, like, you can go to one for undergrad, you can go one of the other ones for grad school, like, just whatever. And as it turned out, that's exactly what happened, as I went to Harvard undergrad and I went to Notre Dame for grad school. So,
Wow, that's really crazy. So what, you're sitting there, you're pondering that, what, at the end of the day, what was it that pushed it over the edge? Was it the fact that you're basically getting a free education at the most prestigious school pretty much in the United States?
It was probably the wrong reason. Like, I mean, it was probably the money. Yeah. I mean, that was like, I just couldn't justify in my mind paying more to go to Notre Dame than to go to Harvard.
To be honest, I don't think it's a bad reason at all. To when you get offered, like you said, it's Harvard. When you get offered that and with the money, and I was under the misinterpretation that Harvard couldn't give out scholarship money. So
they don't. They don't give out scholarships. Like so, Notre Dame, and actually, and that's another thing is the terminology. Like Notre Dame and Duke will give like oh, you've won the, you know, Soren Society scholarship or something like that, and you know. You think, oh, I want a scholarship. But when you look at the end of the day and the financial aid comes in, and well, like a lot of times what they do is they just reduce the financial aid because they say, well, you're getting $10,000 from the Soren scholarship or whatever. So instead of giving you $30,000 in financial aid, we're going to give you $20,000, but now you're getting 10 from over here. So it comes out the same. Harvard doesn't give academic scholarships. They don't give athletic scholarships. They don't give any.
Right.
So anybody who says, well, I'm going to Harvard on full scholarship.
So I wasn't wrong. Not true. I just misinterpreted. Okay.
No, what they do though is they give very generous financial aid. And then people can win outside scholarships. Like, you know, I also had a National Merit Scholarship and you had a couple other things playing in there. But when you're talking about the Harvard's actual packages, it's all done through financial aid. So,
wow. Okay.
But the financial aid part, thankfully, because of, you know, their willingness to give it out. And also because, you know, we qualified income wise, it still made it the best offer out of all the 10 choices.
Yeah, definitely. So now I know we talked a little bit about your time in Harvard, but I'm more curious about your transition from Harvard and how you kind of went. Didn't you go directly into teaching from there?
Pretty much, yeah.
So how did that work out?
It wasn't really planned. I actually thought I was going to do, I mean, coming out of Harvard, there's a couple very popular tracks. I mean, you can go to law school, you can go to med school. Yeah. There's, you know, people who go work at other universities, go straight into grad school. Mm-hmm. And my apologies. There's a lot of folks who go into consulting. And so I kind of thought I was going to go consulting because after all, at 21 years old with a Harvard degree, you must know more than all the, you know, great Fortune 500 companies. And so therefore, you know, you should just go share your wisdom with the world,
right.
You know, with the cloak of McKinsey around you or something. But in any case, I kind of thought that's what I was going to do and had interviewed with a bunch of consulting firms and all. It was 2001 was when I graduated. That was kind of in the midst of the recession. And then of course, and I eventually did have a job sort of lined up and then it was going to start in the fall and then 9/11 happened. And then all that kind of fell apart even more because there was just so much uncertainty in the,
right.
So I ended up coming back to New Jersey and, you know, quite honestly, as I was looking for other options, I was put on hold. Like they kind of deferred my start date at first for the job I was going to start. And I said, well, I'm just sitting around here waiting for the start date to happen. I might as well do something. And so then I started working in the school and coaching and, and I ended up really liking it. And so then, an opening came up and
so you started as a coach before a teacher?
Before I was a full-time teacher, yeah. Wow. So I was kind of like doing a long-term sub situation and then and I started coaching and then when the vacancy happened at the end of the school year and it became clear that the consulting thing wasn't really happening. The school pretty much came to me and were like, "Well, do you want to do this full time?" And I said yes and so then I went through the alternate route program to become certified.
Awesome. So how was the process to get certified and when did you make that decision to actually go to grad programs after that?
Yeah. So the certification process is pretty straightforward. The alternate route program in New Jersey is actually a great program. It was designed really not for people like me. It wasn't intended for people right out of college necessarily. It was designed for people who are mid-career kind of career changers. Particularly, you know, there's always shortages in math and science. It's one of the hardest areas to fill. And in New Jersey, we happen to have a lot of pharmaceutical companies. We've got a lot of high tech places with people who are knowledgeable and certainly qualified to teach things like biology and chemistry, but who may not have had the certification, who then, you know, they work for a big pharma company for 25, 30 years. They retire and they say, hey, look, I'm 55 years old. I'm not old enough to go off into the sunset yet. I want to do something, maybe give back a little bit. And so this program was intended to allow them to come into the classroom, start teaching right away, and then earn their certification during their first year teaching. So that's what it was designed
for.
That's
a cool program.
Yeah. And it was really good. It was relatively painless. It was meeting. I did one. The program I did was through Ramapo, and it was a couple nights a week. And I was very fortunate to have two really, really, you know, helpful and dedicated teachers in that program. Sure. And they were both very knowledgeable, former superintendents, and you know, did that program and became official. And I will say that the hardest part was not the teaching, you know, instruction. It was more the paperwork and the back office stuff, because it was like the state of New Jersey plus the university. Plus, you know, they had to like figure out who gets this check, who gets that check. And that was, and then I had actually started with a program at William Patterson, but theirs was like a weekend based thing, and it wasn't going to work with coaching.
Yeah, with baseball and basketball, I can imagine that was a mess. Yeah.
So I had started there, and I had written a check to them. And then I was like, this isn't going to work schedule-wise. And I found out that Ramapo had an evening schedule. I said, okay, that's going to work better. But then like switching from William Patterson to Ramapo, I think somebody still owes me about $500 in this whole process. But I think William Patterson never gave me back my initial $500 or whatever, but oh well.
That's awesome. Oh my God, you got to go get them now, John. So what was the time frame where you taught and then decided to go back to school, get more education?
So I taught for, so from that point on, I taught for 5 more years. And then I, you know, I really thought I was going to just stay for a couple of years. And then I still was thinking I would go back to law school. And then as time went on, I just kind of felt less and less like I loved the idea of the challenge of law school. I didn't necessarily love the idea of being a lawyer. I kind of cringed at the notion of billable hours and things like that. although it's kind of funny because as time has gone on and, you know, 20 years has passed, I've gotten to know some really wonderful lawyers who do great things. And I think maybe if I had had those, connections back then, maybe I would have felt a little differently, but
I got you.
I really enjoyed what I was doing. I loved the coaching. I loved the teaching, and so I ended up staying much longer than I thought I would.
Right,
5 more years, and then it was two things. One was the I had a class that I had kind of gotten very close with. And then I was like, well, you know, this might be a good breaking point because I can kind of like graduate with them. And then the second piece of it was also like, I said, a bunch of people had told me like, don't wait too long if you're going to go back to school, because even if you're going to stay in teaching, we talked about the salary guides, it makes sense to move laterally across the salary guides. So even if you want to come back to the classroom, go get your master's before, you know, you don't want to wait till be 45 because, you know, you might as well move up the guide now and get paid more for doing the same thing. So I said to myself, well, you know, if I leave right now, I can go get my master's, be done before I'm 30. That probably makes sense, because if I stay here, you know, another 5 years or 10 years, and, you know, at some point you become kind of committed to this is my entire career trajectory. Not that that would have been a bad thing. I loved it when I was there, and I probably would have enjoyed it a lot. But I think I wanted to have some additional options down the road. So that's kind of what pushed me out. And as I applied to schools, I looked at some different programs. And by that point, I had centered on business schools. A couple of my college friends and roommates had done business school and had good experiences there. And it seemed to be relatively flexible as far as a degree path. Like you could come back into education, you could go change careers, you could do a whole bunch of different things with it. And then, so I applied to a bunch of programs, and Notre Dame just kind of blew me away with an offer of, you know, essentially full tuition scholarship. And then I was able to also get a job working in an undergraduate dorm. So I got free room and board to be an advisor. And so I actually ended up making money going to Notre Dame. They paid me a salary to go to school. So
That's actually bizarre. Wow.
It was hard to say no to that.
That's pretty cool though. But so you got the undergrad experience technically at both Harvard and Notre Dame, both mm-hmm. schools that you were really, really considering in the beginning. That's really cool. That seems like it came full circle there.
Yeah. And I mean, Harvard is many things, but it is not a sports school. So to have the opportunity to actually, you know, even though I was there during the Charlie Weiss era, which was probably like, was like the worst 2 years in the history of Notre Dame football, statistically, I think, but still to be able to go to every game, to be there on campus, to see game day, was a lot of fun. And also, you know, all the other sports, I mean, basketball and ice hockey and baseball, it was a lot of fun to kind of be part of that as well.
Yeah, definitely. I could only imagine. Well, I think that leads us pretty well into our conversation with Andrew, where we picked up where we left off. I don't know which one it will actually be, but for everybody else, it'll be just zooming in there. One thing I did want to add, and I think I'll add on to the end of our conversation there as a little extra tidbit, was I want your opinion on how is, have you been looking into AI at all?
You know, only from what I've seen, and I really have not researched it nearly as much as I probably should have. I've seen some of the stuff with like ChatGPT and other AI stuff on like the news.
Are you gonna
and
continue
whatever.
To be professing?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to continue to be professing and teaching going forward?
Probably. Okay. I mean, that's, I don't know, like super long range, how long I'm going to keep on doing this. The class, like, but I think that the problem is not necessarily in the things that I teach. Like, I mean, I'm in graduate school instruction right now. So the students I have are doctoral students, and the assignments are all, you know, they're not necessarily AI kind of things. Like, in my class,
it's not a straight up English class. Yeah.
Oh no! It's a problem solving class essentially. So what I tell them to do is to take a problem that they have in their workplace, and then we apply a bunch of different tools to their problem. So we take their problem, we kind of define their problem statement, we go through a process of root cause analysis and identifying key drivers, and then figuring out you know what actions to take based on those drivers. It's not really the kind of thing AI is going to help with. I mean, if it could, they would have done it already.
I was going to say, I'd be interested to see if one of them brings it up as a solution to a problem in the future.
That's probably more likely where I would encounter it. They are having issues with, I have a number of military folks in my classes, and
oh really, okay,
and I don't know what their ability to use AI kind of technology is, but a lot of the kinds of things that they have had problems with, which are absolutely real and bureaucratic kind of issues, for example, things like there's in the entry levels in the military, you have a lot of turnover. You have folks coming in, you know, new recruits out of basic training who then are given jobs, but they don't have the institutional knowledge, and the people who had those jobs may no longer be at that location.
The ones who have the knowledge they need. Right.
So you kind of have, you know, it's nobody there to train these folks about the new job that they're coming into. And so that was one of the problems that one of my students was trying to deal with. Like, how do we not lose our institutional memory every time we get a new batch of people in here? And there's a whole bunch of promotions, and promotions take people from this base in, I forget where he was, Tennessee or Kentucky or something like that. And then, you know, they go to the previous people go to Texas, and we get new people in, but nobody knows what to do anymore. And there's like this long lag time. Like something like AI could really help with.
I was going to say that sounds like an AI problem.
But in terms of like actually like get doing the work. Now, I think when you're talking about something like, high school algebra.
Well, what I was going to actually ask more importantly would be, I take it back to you go back to your AP Gov class that you taught in Kinnelon. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, in that class, are you more so worried about it? Because you could have the most stellar student who's putting on a show, but when it comes to the AP test, they get a 2. And, you know, as a teacher, it's going to break your heart, because the whole time to you, it's looking like effort's been putting in, but in reality, it's been a computer that's been functioning as a brain the whole time. That's where I more so see it taking effect.
You know, you're absolutely right. I think that it's incumbent upon the teachers to find ways to assess students that are not going to allow for AI or any any other types of interventions. There are programs like Turnitin and things like that that will check for plagiarism on papers.
I think it's beating it at this point. I'm pretty sure ChatGPT is beating the Turnitin papers.
But there's a real simple solution to that, and that is, guess what, kids? We're going to write an essay, and you're going to be here in class, and I'm going to hand you a piece of paper and a pen, and it's going to be in your handwriting, and you don't have computers, you don't have this, you don't have that. You use your textbook if you want, but, you know, if you can't...
I couldn't agree more, yep.
I will say that takes time to grade. It takes time in class to assess. It takes, you know, reading student handwriting is... you know, the bane of every teacher's existence, but you know, at the end of the day, and I could see that when I had kids who turned in really, really nice typewritten papers for their take-home assignments. And then when it comes to the time, like every single test I gave, there was usually a multiple choice portion or something where I'd get objective answers. Mm-hmm. And then I typically, I'd have what they call identifications, where I'd give them certain terms, and they had to write me a passage about, you know, what's the significance of this thing,
right?
And then there was an essay, and the essay and the essay and the IDs were worth more than half of the test. So if you couldn't do anything on those,
okay,
I passed my class. And
yeah, but that's a well structured class, and don't you think, you know, especially with the way that teaching has headed in its direction the last couple of years, with COVID becoming almost completely online in some cases. Don't you think that in some cases, educational system might have put itself in too big of a hole to breach for this problem?
Yeah. I think the COVID presented all sorts of challenges that we hadn't seen before. Yeah. And that's just one of many, and probably for the last couple of years. I mean, in the classroom, in the high school classroom the last couple of years, you know, you probably just have to give in, because if you don't see your kids in person, there's really no way you can, you know, assess for
that's
that.
That's my point, though, yeah. That's
although there point. Are
is
questions.
Now you got to reel back.
There's ways of writing questions, though, that make the answer, I don't exactly know how some of the new AI stuff, I feel like most of this AI stuff has kind of come out in the last, you know, year to two.
It's been about the last 2 years, year and a half.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And so I think, like, during the worst of COVID, I don't know that all that was out there, or at least
no, it wasn't. It's more
high school kids.
It's more going to affect basically now and going forward.
And so I think, you know, some of it just is the willingness to go back to paper and pencil, at least for maybe not for every assessment, but it only takes one or two to be able to see if
to actually have a barometer on the student.
Students are really, you know, getting what you're teaching. And then I think the other piece of it is structuring questions in such a way that it's not something that could easily be answered by a Google
search. I think that's important, because you just mentioned it right there. Okay. So as I've been using more of ChatGPT and trying to play around with the AI and whatnot, all I'm realizing is that it's just a glorified Google. It's just a one answer Google. And you tell it what the answer is, it's actually kind of trying to work with you, but it's heavily moderated. It's getting its answers from Google, essentially. And it's just one answer. So if you can do the same thing you were doing with Google, because you know kids were using Google the whole time you were teaching, you just manipulate that question a little bit more vaguely, or have that AI have to generate its own thoughts, and all of a sudden, words are being made up out of whole cloth, stuff's getting taken out of context, and I think it would be easy to tell.
Yeah, and I think again that's why when you write a question, or if you're, I actually wish this was part of teacher education a little bit more, is how do you structure assignments in such a way that it forces independent thought. I've had a few people who do this really, really well, but I still also see, you know, test questions like, you know, describe the events of 1776, or, you know, what did George Washington do as president, or things like that. Well, I mean, you're basically asking them to do a Google search, and
you're asking them for a vague answer. Yeah.
And just to spit back a bunch of information that, I mean, realistically, nobody knows coming out of the womb, like what George Washington did as president. Like, it's something you have to get from somewhere. And I mean, ideally you'd love for students to be able to read their textbook and remember it. But, you know, aside from doing that kind of a question on a pen and paper test where they don't have resources, like, you know, if you're putting them in front of a computer, like, what are they going to do? Of course they're going to use Google. It's just not, but there's also a way of structuring a question that makes it such that it's not just a Google answer. Maybe you can get information. You could find primary sources to back you up. You could do things like that from Google. And if that's the case, well, then you're fine with students using Google to find those pieces of information, but it's writing a question that's going to force students to make an argument, to use sources to defend that argument. And that's not something that a Google search is necessarily going to do for you.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm glad you said that, because that was a lot of how I did a lot of my school research, especially because a lot of our sources ended up being available online. I just ended up Googling a lot of stuff. And you just take bits and pieces out of it. But the biggest thing is, are you taking it from the Wikipedia page, or are you taking it from whatever source document and actually trying to read in? Or are you getting analysis from someone who's noteworthy that actually has something to say on the topic, or are you just reading a Twitter post, right? So there's a lot of ambiguity online. So I really like what you said there, John. And we have educational issues that I think are stemming from a lot of different pinpoints I think you're mentioning, John. And so is there a reasonable way that we could attack it? Like, is it a problem that has enough laid out that we have an ability to actually go checklist, like we just mentioned, and actually go at the problem? Or has it become so widespread and so ingrained in our system that we might need an actual new education system? Like, you've been in it long enough to give more of a viable opinion, I think, than anybody on the internet.
Yeah, I think that there are a number of problems. I think that it's not just one problem. And so I think that, in fact, ironically, what I teach now to my doctoral students class essentially on problem solving. And, you know, no matter how idealistic you might be and how committed you might be, if you're trying to solve 25 things at once, you're probably not going to solve any of them. So you got to say, okay, the first thing I need to solve is the recruitment of new teachers into the profession, or the, you know, figuring out ways to find people to teach difficult to staff subjects, the languages, the sciences, ESL, special ed, and figure out ways to better do that. And, you know, or if you're talking about a bigger system level thing, like, how do you fix some of the challenges of large school districts where you have, you know, I think some of the numbers coming out of places like, you know, Baltimore, I think had a large number of schools that didn't have a single student pass their state tests.
I saw that. That's mind baffling to me.
So, like, depending on which of those problems you want to go tackle, I think your approaches are going to be a little different.
Correct.
And none of them are going to be quick, because these are all longstanding entrenched problems. And one of the problems in education is that we tend to dive towards quick fix solutions, because And it's usually for a noble reason, in that everybody says, well, we can't wait a second because these kindergartners aren't learning how to read. And if we don't teach them how to read, then they're, you know, their whole educational trajectory is going to be off. So we need to do something right now. So let's come up with a quick fix solution. And it feels good in a sort of, you know, warm and fuzzy way that I'm doing something about the problem. But if it's not thought out, if it hasn't really identified the true root causes of the problem, and if it's just kind of superficially attacking whatever's going on, you're really not going to make distinct inroads in that problem. You know, real
so
solutions.
You think the problem is too big?
No, I think you have to decide which problem you're going to solve and then tackle that specifically, and gotcha. then move on to the next one. So if your right. issue is, you know, retaining teachers because you know, then you got to say, all right, well, why aren't teachers staying in the profession? And you can look at it. Well, maybe it's other fields have more competitive salaries. Maybe the working conditions aren't the best, so on and so forth. And you see, well, what are the driving factors? What are the primary drivers of what's going on that's causing people to leave the profession early instead of staying in for 30-year careers?
Right.
And then you say, okay, well, maybe I can't fix the all of the salary stuff. I can't just make millions and millions of dollars appear, but what can I do with the money I do have to better incentivize the real top performers to stay? And then you can say, all right, well, right. maybe I can't raise everybody's salary across the board, but I can put in some performance pay or whatever. And you can do trials like that and see what works and what doesn't. And honestly, there's probably going to be some degree of getting things right and getting things wrong. And you do see some innovative cities out there that are trying things, but I think the larger and more complicated an institution is, like doing things new in New York City public schools or LA Unified or CPS, it's just so hard because they're so big and
it's
so
almost
complicated.
Unreasonable. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the most innovative stuff is coming out of like the charter world and the private world at this point, just because if you're a sole operator, a single charter school, you can be a lot more creative with how you use your money. You can create stipends, you can create leadership tiers where you can give some people a sense of career advancement. You start off as a teacher, then you move to like a teacher leader, maybe then a teacher mentor. And then, you know, maybe at some point you're kind of like moving into administrative roles, and there's a lot more of a career ladder. Whereas in the traditional public school system, you pretty much are a teacher. And then if you wanted to go get a degree in school administration, you could try to be like a vice principal or a principal, but that's like almost like a totally different, right. It's not just even a, hey, you're a great teacher, so let's just promote you. You got to go get these extra certifications and right. the hoops to jump through, like in New Jersey, like I did my doctorate at Vanderbilt, doctorate in educational, you know, leadership, and yet I just can't come back to New Jersey and be a principal at a public school.
You have to go get certified specifically for New Jersey.
Exactly, because there's New Jersey specific courses. There's one on school budgeting that you have to take. There's another on like school safety, I think, and those are things that you have to do in New Jersey. So if I wanted to go be a school principal in New Jersey, I'd have to go through like the NJXL program, right. which is like a year long and not cheap program where you go, you know, a couple times a week to classes and have an existing principal or vice principal who's your mentor and go through like a year long process. And then you can get your certification. Now, if that had been my goal all along, I could have gone to a New Jersey accredited school. Right, done my degree here, and then that would have been baked into it, but that wasn't necessarily my intention.
Right. Yeah, but that's just bizarre that they're that unwilling to work with outside. But I mean, that probably plays a small part as well in the bucket that we have to pick from when we're talking about our New Jersey teachers. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I did want to bring up that I was curious to find out when I did was that, generally speaking, when you go and teach in a private institution, you're actually going to get paid less.
That's true.
And
by and large,
that's to me, that's pretty shocking because you would think the opposite, especially as a parent from the outside looking in.
You're paying all that tuition essentially for what you can get the equivalent in the public schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the tuition tends to go for the beautiful campus and the endowment and all that kind of stuff. Now it is true, and you know, Catholic schools pay probably by and large the least. Private schools, you know, maybe a touch more, but definitely less than the public system. In fact, unless you are, even if you're a junior professor at most universities, you'd actually make more as a public school teacher at the top of the guide. So if you have a doctorate, and if you actually, the hard thing is to get hired with a doctorate, because you know, if a school system sees that you have a doctorate, then they know
they're going to have to.
Wow, you're expensive, which is why you tend to see people with doctorates in hard to fill subjects, like, for example, chemistry or physics. But you don't necessarily see people with doctorates teaching English, because English teachers are a lot easier to find, and they don't want to, you know, put all that salary towards an English teacher. The better districts, they're going to hire the right people no matter what. But if you're in a district that's cutting costs, then like, you know, somebody with an MA 60 or a doctorate is going to have a hard time getting a job.
Wow.
Do you think that a private school teacher who does make a lot less, do you think that affects the quality of the education of the students who attend that private school at all? Or do you think it doesn't make much of a difference?
I think it probably is case by case basis. I think those private schools, you do get a little more flexibility. Your course load isn't quite as heavy. Class sizes tend to be smaller. So I think, like, if you're a maybe like a younger, less experienced teacher thrown into the choice of a public school or a private school, yes, you might be making less money at a private school, but I think there's probably a little more in the way of guardrails for your success, in that at a private school, at public schools, too often discipline gets thrown back at classroom teachers, and they're told to deal with it. At a private school, there's a little bit more of a stick. If, you know, a student really is acting out, they can be kicked out of the school, which doesn't really happen in public schools.
So there's ways that it balances out.
Yeah. And certainly, like, the number of students that you have and the number of courses that you're teaching. I mean, I had a couple of years where I had six classes and in excess of 120 students. And, you know, that's, I think one year I was almost at 150 students. It was like 142 or something at the start of the year. It's just really hard. I mean, to deal with that, you know, and I wasn't even a rookie teacher at that point. But if you want to give legitimate assignments, like I really emphasized writing. In fact, I always said at the beginning of my classes, like, I'm going to try to teach you history. I will teach you how to write. And the only way you're going to do that is by giving a lot of writing assignments and giving good feedback on those. But to give feedback on 140,
that takes, you know, time. That's a
seven
lot
or eight
time.
Page papers. That takes an enormous amount of time. So if I had 70 students instead of 140, I could have given way more detailed feedback, more timely, probably done more, you know, iterations and said, okay, here, do this first, then I'll give you some feedback, then you do it revision. When you're dealing with 140 kids, you just can't do that. So,
yeah, I think that's pretty plain to see. Now, when you shifted over to university education, was that like a kind of a challenge that you put on yourself to go and do that?
No, it actually kind of happened. I was working for State of New Jersey, and I was doing my doctorate at the same time, and finished my doctorate, and that year, I finished in 2018. That fall, Vanderbilt decided that they were going to launch an online doctoral program. And you know, I had previous teaching experience, and so they, I guess I was a good enough student that they were like, you know, hey, you could probably teach something here. You have teaching experience before, and now you've got a doctorate. Would this be interesting to you? And I kind of had said, well, yeah, you know, it would. it would be nice to stay in doing something teaching related. And so I said, all right, you know, I'm game. And then I kind of learned how to teach online. We started on this Adobe Connect type platform, which was kind of clunky. And then eventually we transitioned to Zoom, which was much easier to work with. But I had to kind of figure out how do I build my lesson plans, my slide decks, all that kind of stuff. How do I get used to right. teaching to a computer?
Completely remote.
But, you know, but they really came to me and asked me if I wanted to do it. And I said yes. And then the irony is that the reason that they were looking for, you know, a newly minted doctorate person to go teach these classes was because none of the senior faculty wanted to teach online. They already had their slideshows. They had their lessons. Like, I've been doing the same thing since 1974. You can't make me change. And, you know, then all of a sudden COVID hit and then they had to change. So, right. But I kind of got in on the ground floor of this online teaching thing. So.
Yeah, definitely. So now you're still, if I'm not mistaken, you're still doing some stuff with the state of New Jersey as well. Or just kind of
not if I can help it. No.
So as you had to see, I guess you've been around New Jersey education for so long, has it been, because I'm just too young to remember, has it been a steady decline or did it happen? In my mind, it happened around when my brother was younger. It seemed like I was getting to about my freshman year, maybe my eighth grade year. And so this would be something like 2013, 14. And all of a sudden it seemed like the education system changed and it changed with a reason to try to teach me something I didn't want to learn.
Well, okay. So I would say it, I don't know that it's quite so much there was a one inflection point where things
right, which is how I doubt it could ever be true that that's
the rails. You know, it's also when you're talking about statewide, you know, New Jersey has a very long and complicated history of, in fact, it's one of the more interesting cases of, you know, across the whole country, because of our system. New Jersey, I think the last time I checked, had 601 independent school districts.
Oh, I think we were talking about this at some point. Yeah.
Most states tend to do education on a county level. Maybe if they have a big city, the city schools might be one system, but then the counties kind of handle a lot of the other educational duties. Mm-hmm. New Jersey, every little burg and borough has its own school district. And as a result, you get wild variations. And it's always been the case that, you know, that there's a handful of towns and a handful of counties that are some of the best education opportunities in the whole country. I mean,
if you look at New Jersey, 100%.
I would put New Jersey's top, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 towns up against, you know, just about any other public school system in the whole country. And then there's also a handful of
like the
very, you know, challenging districts where, you know, education has always been a difficult thing. And, you know, you can go back to the Abbott v. Burke decision, which was in the early 80s, where they were talking about the differential treatment of the so-called Abbott districts, the low-income districts. And, and then there was a number of other decisions, therefore, that followed that. The whole concept in the New Jersey Constitution guarantees a, quote, thorough and efficient education to New Jersey students. And so definitions of what thorough and efficient means are kind of subjective. The state's usual answer has been, have we thrown enough money at it? And so a lot of it comes down to funding. And that's not entirely, it's not entirely off base because you don't want underfunded schools. Certainly a school that has a large percentage of non-native English speakers is going to have costs and needs that are different than a school where everybody comes to school reading and writing English.
Right.
But that said, I think it's made a lot of the larger districts into these kind of slush fund districts where you see, you know, huge amounts of middle management people who really don't contribute a lot to the educational output of what really happens on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, and there's also, anytime you get a big system, the big companies have waste, big government institutions have waste, big school districts have waste. You know, if you're like a, you know, little Kinnelon with one K2 and 1-3-5 and one middle school and one high school, it's a little easier to spot waste than it is in a school with, you know, 54 schools.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that point you bring up is not just true to education. I think it's true. I think you even said it to a lot of big systems when it gets big. Yeah.
And, you know, companies are like, you know, people who say, well, oh, the private market is so much more efficient. Well, you know, like I remember my dad.
Not necessarily.
No, not at all. In fact, my dad used to go, he was a tax auditor, and he would go to companies, all different companies. You know, each week he'd be at someplace different. And he went to one large multinational company that was headquartered in New Jersey. I remember him just retelling a conversation he had with the tax manager there. They're walking down the hallway, and one person walks by with tennis rackets, and somebody else walks by with, like, you know, like they're about ready to go for a run, and somebody else walks by, you know, with like paintings under their arm. And he's like, does anybody work here? And the tax manager just kind of shook his head and was like, we don't fire anybody. It's just easier to carry them, you know, because we're just going to, you know, so they get to a point, they reach a certain plateau, they put in their time, and then if they kind of check out, we just carry them. And so, like, there's waste in companies too. It's easier for a big institution to say, you know what, we're just going to pay the salary, than it is to go through the hassle and stress and all that of trying to fire somebody. So yeah, I think the where that would never happen in like a mom and pop deli, you know, if somebody was sitting there going off and playing tennis every day, they would get fired. It would, you know, you can't carry somebody in a small mom and pop business. It just, like, you can't it would stand out much more in a small school or district.
Yeah, exactly. That makes a lot of sense for me. Now, Andrew, do you have anything else on education? Because I want to give this guy a break.
Yes, actually, I had one very important question, I think. I believe, so tenure, I believe tenure is what, 5 years?
I believe it's four. School teacher in New Jersey? It was three when I was there, and now I believe it's up to four. It's four, but it's there's a revocable thing that there was not. Like, it used to be three, and if you put in your 3 years in a day, you were set for life, and short of like beating up a kid, there was nothing in the world that was ever going to take it away.
And that's kind of my question, is that, like, we were talking about the pension system and how that can kind of keep some like dead weight retained. Do you think having that tenure bar be set so relatively low, do you think that can be harmful?
Yeah, I think that's actually the bigger issue than the pension thing, really. And the pension is more of a reward, and I honestly look at it more as like a deferred salary, because you're saying, it's kind of like, if you win the lottery, do you take all the money up front and pay all the taxes up front, or do you say, I'll take the annuity and get it paid out over time? If you really are committed to a teaching career, and you say, look, yes, this year, I'm in year one, I'm going to make, I guess the starting salary in New Jersey now is around 50. I'll make 50 grand. And yes, I could probably make 75 or 80 on the open market, but I'll make my 50 this year. I'll make 52 next year. And then somewhere down the road, I'll get a master's. And by the end of my career, I'll be making, you know, the people at the top of the chart are making 100, 110, whatever. Like
95 to 105, I think.
Yeah. But then when I retire, I'll be getting 3/4 of that for the rest of my life.
Right.
And so, and I've deferred my payments up front to the back end. So the people who really you know, the people who go into the profession for a couple of years and then leave, they're in some ways, you know, missing out on that long-term benefit that right. the people who stay in the career do receive eventually. But the 10-year thing, I think that's where it becomes a lot stickier, because, you know, it's sort of like you can put on a show for, you know, especially when you know that there's observations coming and scheduled and all that.
Exactly.
It's easy to play
pretend for that short amount of time.
Yeah. And I've been on the other side where I've been the evaluator going into classrooms, and like, there's like this ridiculous, you know, circus almost going on of like, here, let me show you all the wonderful things we're doing. And, and it's like, okay, I know this isn't every day, because I know I've seen what goes on. I've walked past your room other days. Like, I know this isn't what usually happens here. So, and I think in too many places where once you get hired, if you put in your 3 years and, you know, keep your head down and don't get, you know, in trouble in any way, you kind of, we had one guy I worked with who just struggled to show up on time. Like, my gosh, like, it's the basic thing, just show up on time and you're probably going to get tenure. But if you don't show up, you know, you're going to get yourself in trouble.
Right.
But, now there is a way to, if somebody does get tenure, they can theoretically lose tenure if they have a certain number of consecutive very, very poor evaluations.
Really?
But okay. It's really hard.
I feel like
to
it's
going to
be hard to get to that point.
Because it is, you can play because, that act again when you know that evaluation is coming.
And if you have even one satisfactory, it then resets.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think it's something like you have to have, I don't quote me on this because I'm not 100% sure, but it's something like three consecutive unsat. Like one puts you on probation. Mm-hmm. Then the second one is like, you know, this is really bad, or 2 years in a row or something like that, whatever it is.
Be careful, but, John. We already got in trouble with YouTube once today.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's going to get into YouTube jail, but
I hope not.
In any case, there is a way that you can
actually
have tenure revoked, but it's really hard. And I think it still is extraordinarily rare.
I'm sure.
I think, yes. So to answer your question, Andrew, I think that is a bigger hurdle. You look at schools, you know, it's in the best interest of schools to have stability in their workforces. You look at charter schools that don't have tenure, and by and large, once teachers are there for 3 years, they don't get fired. Like, it just doesn't happen. Like, if you've proved yourself, like, usually where in the charter schools, if you're not doing your job, you're going to be out very quickly. If you're there for 3 or 4 years and you've proved that you know what you're doing, like, they're going to try to keep you as long as they possibly can, because turnover tends to be relatively high in the field. So in some ways, I think that tenure is solving an imagined problem, that there's this notion that if there wasn't tenure, well, then they just fire us left and right. And that's, you know, you look in the rest of the world, the rest of private industry, you just don't fire people, you know, left and right if they're doing a good job.
And that's the thing. If you do a good job, like, what? Why is there a worry about potentially being terminated?
Yeah, when is tenure even existing?
Yeah, I think that in the world of like a pension qualification thing, that becomes a little... I think there's a little bit of a fear that somebody who starts off on a bachelor's degree is a cheap hire. Then they get, you know, they work their way up. They amass a couple other degrees. They move up to the top of the guide. Now they're a lot more expensive. That a school district that was looking to cut costs could say, well, let's get rid of these really expensive teachers and go bring in some fresh out of college kids. And I suppose there could be some really short-sighted districts and administrators out there that might do something like that. So I'm not going to completely discount that notion, but I mean, any administrator that has any you know, credibility in the world is going to say, hey, if this teacher is actually good,
right,
you know, it's worth it to pay that person what they're worth rather than hire somebody off the street who may be gone after 2 months. And then I got to kind of have a revolving door right. of, and kids aren't learning anything. So, and again, I think that the school systems that are the smaller and more personal you can get, the less likely you would have that sort of, you know, blind budget conscious, you know, cutting.
I agree.
You know, you'd say, hey, look, you know, I know Mrs. So-and-so is a great teacher and, you know, we're going to keep her as long as she can.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Andrew, you killed it. One last question. Really, lastly, all I wanted to touch on was, I know you made a really good point offhand, off the air about the tenure situation. And I thought it was a good point to be made because I think the way that we were talking about it with Andrew on the podcast was heavily angled from the outside looking in on teachers. I don't think it really gave a perspective of what the system is like. And it's kind of what our whole show was about, was the systems. Yep. So would you mind bringing it down a little bit for myself and the viewers about what it's like in that, I guess in those trenches as a teacher, once you're actually in there 3, 4, 5 years?
Yeah. No, I think it's a really important point. Maybe something that we missed earlier was the fact that, the tenure system and the pension system and all these systems that exist in education, they exist and have existed long before any of us got here. And so as a new teacher entering the system, you know, you become part of that. Those are the rules that you're playing by. And so I think that anybody who wants to, you know, even if you don't like tenure, you don't like the system, you don't like the fact that, you know, there's a huge amount of money that goes into the pension system, all that. Like the proper course of action is not to blame teachers, because teachers, you don't have any say. That's the system that you're joining.
Right.
You know, it's the nature of the profession, and that's part of the deal that you're agreeing to at the time. Like if you're, and we talked about some of these folks that are changing careers from private industry to
getting into education,
becoming teachers, you know, in a field like a chemistry. Well, you can make more money as a chemist in just a lot of other
pharmaceuticals
fields
or working for big oil. Yep.
Sure. Then you can as a high school teacher. So you're making that decision. Like, look, I'm going to go and be a teacher. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make less money up front. That's kind of the nature of the game, because I'm on a salary chart and this is what the only amount I'm going to make now, but there are other benefits. There's typically good medical. There's, you know what the contract hours are. You've got this pension system. You know, there is certain job security inherent in tenure if you can get it. So all of these things are part of that. And that's, in many ways, it's part of compensation that teachers get. Like, yes, you don't get compensated as much up front, but maybe you do better on the pension end in the back end. Maybe you don't have the, you know, the kind of perks that you might get, you know, teacher appreciation. I believe today is Teacher Appreciation Day or week or whatever, which is kind of funny because, you know, Teacher Appreciation Week often involves, like, you know, cookies in the break room or something, which is very nice. But it's,
the pizza instead of the raise, right? You see all the
Yeah. and when you see, like, you know, I had a colleague at the Department of Education whose son was he worked for Stryker as a sales something or another. You know, he was very, very good at what he did and all, but like, and he would, you know, often get their top salesperson and whatever. And like, he's getting, you know, trips to the islands and, you know,
right,
fancy, you know, cruises and all this other kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, we get pizza and cookies in the break room. Yep. But so there are certain things that you're giving up, but there's also certain things that you're getting. There's a job security that, you know, if you have tenure and you're doing your job, you know, you're going to continue to have a job as opposed to, you know, if 1 year, you know, no matter how much they want to send you to the islands and, you know, make a big deal out of you, if all of a sudden you're, you know, you kind of stop producing and, you know, your sales go way down, you might be out of a job. So there's a certain, you know, security that goes with it. So ultimately, like, you know, you can critique the system and even work to change the system, but the appropriate thing to do is not to, to point fingers and blame anybody who's part of the system, because that's, it's the system. I mean, just like we're all bought into the system, you know, nationally, of things like Social Security and Medicare and, and all that. We may not love the systems. We may think that they were poorly conceived when they were founded, or they haven't been updated sufficiently. I mean, the, if you look at the life expectancy today versus what it was in the 30s when Social Security came in, I mean, it's got a totally different meaning now than it did back then. And we can critique that all we want, but the folks who are retired now, who paid in, you know, their whole careers and who expected to get this benefit, you know, you can't sit there and blame the seniors for saying, well, you greedy seniors, you're getting, taking all this money. Well, that's what they were, you know, that's the deal. That was what they were promised. So I think that any solutions have to, you know, be more, you know, forward looking and saying, okay, well, from now on, here's what we're going to do. And then also, you know, think about how do we, you know, keep the promises we've made to people along the way, maybe making the systems better than they are now. But it's very, very difficult. And that's why I think you're seeing in many places, it's easier to do disruptive change than it is to do incremental change. It's easier.
It's easier to bite the bullet. It's easier, especially when it's gone down a road so far.
Yes, I think. Well, in incremental change, like, for example, change within the system is, it's tough because, you know, you're going to have folks who are, I mean, every point is going to be, well, every point is going to be contested, and you have to say, okay, well, I'm going to give you this and we give you that. And there becomes like this give and take. So when a system is really, you know, not working properly, what you see is you know, outside solutions. You see things like virtual schools, you see charters coming in where you're, people can come in and start from a clean slate and say, hey, we're going to do something differently here. And it's, you know, it's interesting. But there's, I think that the challenge for us is to not break the system any worse than it has been. And I think that there's been times when that has occurred. And that's, those are really unfortunate points in our history, because you can point, look back and say, you know, we had something better, and it,
it's, you know, it's because of this point,
because of decisions that were made, we've really, we dropped the ball on something. And
Well, I would love just to close it on this point then. If, with all that being said, you know, we highlighted quite a few issues that were way beyond just tenure or pension or anything else in one specific iota. Would there be, like, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 things that you would just hope get implemented soon or get talked about that you see just yourself, that are just obvious?
I would say, for one thing, it's been,
this is specifically on education for everybody.
Of course,
by the way, I'm sorry for sorry for being so vague.
You know, I think we've had a, it's been very difficult to start getting into a system where performance is evaluated by metrics, and it's kind of, there's been a there's a whole bunch of, like, teaching to the test is one concept that and like, those are not healthy things. I mean, In some respects, you've had these debates that are, we're still using arguments of, based on what was going on 10, 15 years ago. And technology has evolved, testing has evolved, data has evolved, and yet we're still making the same exact arguments that we did at that time. You know, when they first came out and they said, all right, we're going to say, we're going to evaluate teachers based on the performance of students, the tests were not always the most informative. They could tell you, yes, this student did better than that student, but we didn't necessarily have a growth trajectory. Tests from one grade level to the next weren't necessarily aligned. You'd have, in fact, it was well known in certain states that like the seventh grade test was really hard and then the eighth grade test was really easy. And so, you know, you'd have these wildly varying passage
year by year and answers and stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The technology has gotten a lot better. The leveling has gotten a lot better. I think that we have a much better concept, and we have data warehouses of longitudinal growth that are tied to unique student identifiers. So we can punch in your student number and we can see where you were every single year. We can see years that maybe you made more growth, years that you made less growth. And maybe one student had a bad year at home or whatever and didn't make as much growth, but then another student probably had a good year and there was you're going to see data that's going to suggest where teacher effectiveness comes in. And I think that
overall patterns, maybe you're looking at over 8 years or 5 years, right?
Right. And when you have longitudinal data on students, and you can sit there and also norm that against a much, much bigger sample size where you have students over an entire district or state taking the same exam.
By the same teacher or teachers. Yeah.
It's not just when it first came out, it was like, how many students of yours passed? Well, if all of your students were coming in way below proficient, you might be the greatest teacher in the world and you might not have that many students actually quote unquote pass.
Makes sense. But right.
Now we have the data to show what growth metrics are coming into play. And that's where we can really look at how effective a teacher was. If a teacher is able to grow students more than the average teacher would, more than most teachers would.
Gotcha.
And there are places in the country that are doing this much better. Right now it's primarily ELA and math, but I think we can look at other fields to figure out how to assess some of these things better. I think there's also a teacher practice component that could come into this, but I think that, that for a long time, education has been opposed to looking at any sort of outcomes as a worthy method of evaluating teachers. And that's, it's just it's part of a system that is based on the sort of plug and play mentality that one certified English teacher is, can be substituted for another certified English teacher at any point. And that we all know that that's not true. We had wonderful teacher, we had some
everyone's good had a good one.
That's an average teacher. Mm-hmm. We've had, And I think that we need to do more to recognize those teachers that really do make a significant difference. And also, therefore, I think that's where you could actually see some movement in the way the system works, is that if we could then compensate people who really are exceptional, because the solution has always been, if a teacher is really good, what do? You promote them and you make them a vice principal.
So then he's no longer a teacher. He's no longer doing the thing he's good at.
Right. Because, this teacher, he or she might have been a wonderful, English teacher, but may not want to have anything to do with discipline or whatever a vice principal does on a daily basis. That teacher might just really want to teach English. And so there's got to be some type of recognition and your career ladder aspect.
There should be nothing wrong with having a high paid, high performing teacher. If they do a good job and they earn their money, I don't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah. And the other thing I think is when you look at systems, like the systems that are really struggling. I mean, here in New Jersey, I mentioned earlier, we had 601 independent school districts. And, probably half of them do really good work on an average basis. And, some could probably be a little better. But we know that there are some systems that really struggle. And I think that it should not be the role of governments or any other organizations to get in the way of any progress that might improve the opportunities available to students. So you look at some cities that have done a lot of work encouraging innovation zones, having charters, having nonprofits that come in to support education. there has to be a better way forward. I mean, it's not, I don't think anybody is saying we need to completely, you know, we don't want to necessarily privatize all of education or get rid of public schools or get rid of teachers or get rid of, I mean, there has to be some, you know, I taught in a public school. I went to a public school. I'm also on the board of a charter school. I've been, you know, involved in some Catholic schools. I don't consider myself to be an evangelist for, you know, any particular school configuration. I think that we need great public schools. Right. Charter schools are public schools in almost every instance in almost every state. And so, you know, I think we do need to have that option as part of, you know, promoting a sort of democratic equality in the country, as we don't have, public schools can't compete with private schools, well, then we're really not living up to what our, you know, our, really all of our national history is about.
Sure, absolutely.
But we can't be tied to one type of school, you know, organizational structure.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to be made too.
Like, if we have a lousy charter school, it should close. If we have a lousy Catholic school, it should close. If we have a lousy public school, it should close. Or, you know, or get help or get, you know, reconfigured or, you know, something has to change because we shouldn't have lousy schools.
It shouldn't just get neglected because, they don't have that many students, so it's really not affecting that many families.
Right. Nor is the solution just like, well, we're going to get rid of all the public schools and make them all charters, because I've seen some really lousy charter schools too. Yeah. I mean, there are
especially
some that are
when
wonderful.
They have the monopoly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are some that are wonderful, but there are also some that are really terrible. And, you know, just because something is a charter doesn't make it great. Just because something is a public school doesn't make it great or bad or whatever.
Definitely.
And I think we need to kind of, when it gets into the world of politics, we tend to get a lot of these absolutes where people are arguing,
especially now.
A particular school type. I think that the choice is really important. I believe that having a marketplace is really important, and there are relatively few places in the country where we really do have a true marketplace. There's factors like transportation and geography and access that all sort of play into it. So, I mean, I probably could count on, you know, two hands the number of cities that are really promising in terms of the amount of a marketplace that actually exists. But but I think that may be something that we could see down the road. So I think,
definitely,
you know, when you're talking about solving problems and what are some of the drivers of it, you know, being able to retain and attract high quality teachers to the field. And some of that has to be changing the way that teachers are recognized and compensated. And then also the school configurations and figuring out how do we ensure higher quality schools as a whole. And that's people kind of sometimes being a little bit less tied to their particular, you know, fiefdoms and saying, look, you know what? There's a Catholic school doing wonderful things, or there's a charter school doing wonderful things, or a public school doing wonderful things. What are they doing? How do we try to be more like that?
Or get them more funding and more kids in the door because they're doing something right.
Yeah. And I think when you look at how some cities have tackled this, there's been cities that have actually done studies of like, where are our high quality seats? Like, how many schools do we have in this part of the city that have really high quality education options? And then if they say, okay, well, we got the north side is really well covered, but the south side isn't, we need to really incentivize, you know, either new operators to come into the south side, or we need to inject, maybe take one of our public schools and turn it into some sort of innovation school, pay teachers an incentive to go to that school, find ways to improve the quality of that particular school. And it can be done. I think that there are tools that are available to system level leaders, and we need to be a little bit more willing to use those tools.
Yeah, just open to it. Well, John, I want to thank you. I know we ran definitely longer than either you or I were expecting to, but love the conversation. I'll get to putting this together, probably have it out next week, but this was just fantastic. And I think we really covered some bases that were, I know in my head were kind of scratching at it. Like, I feel like we could have talked even a little deeper. So I just can't thank you enough for coming on. And like I said, we'll try to arrange Father Ed soon. So
my pleasure. Well, it's been great talking to you, Sal.
Oh, thank you, John. And everybody else, go check us out. New website's out. So if you haven't, go take a look at it. For now.
I wish I were the fucking state. I wanna be something, not nothing. Trapped inside my dream and I'm running. Running away from these demons. But the feeling's so good, I'ma keep dreaming.